from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, in our next hour, Consul and Foreign Relations President Richard Haass had been on the shortlist to be Deputy Secretary of State under President Donald Trump. Now he's speaking out against the president's recent immigration ban.
It's bad for American universities. It's bad for the American economy. A lot of these people, either who are here already or who would come here, would fill our schools, would work for our major technology and other firms.
Richard Haass will join us to talk about foreign policy under Trump and his new book, A World in Disarray. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. In A World in Disarray, Consul on Foreign Relations President Richard Haass offers a warning. In this age of climate change, global terrorism, and nuclear proliferation, nations must adopt a new mantle of international responsibility and obligation. As President Trump enters his second week in the Oval Office, Richard Haass joins us to discuss the role of the United States in maintaining global stability, and we'll also get his thoughts on the foreign policy implications of President Trump's executive order on immigrants and refugees and the growing dissent at the United States State Department over the travel ban. And we welcome Richard Haass back to the Forum program. Great to have you with us.
Thank you, Michael. Good to be back.
So I'd like to begin by maybe talking a little bit about the nation in disarray, if we could, since this is, of course, the most powerful nation in the world. And I use that word, as you do in your title, because it appears to many as if we're moving into pretty chaotic times here. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this, particularly in light of the ban and particularly in light of those who have come under, shall we say, difficulties as a result of the Trump presidency right in these first few days?
Well, the short answer, Michael, is I fear you're right. And it wasn't obvious because, you know, at first glance, you might think a country with a Republican president and a Republican control of both chambers of Congress would be anything but a country in disarray. But in some ways, Donald Trump is not a Republican. He's much more of a nationalist and an intervener, and you know, we could use other descriptions of his policy. And so we really don't have a united Washington. And then more broadly, this country is deeply divided on issues of politics, to some extent class, geographically. And the inaugural address, in many ways, I thought, rather than an attempt to bridge the divides, in some ways exacerbated them or highlighted them. So here we are less than 2 weeks into this presidency. And yes, we do have a country in disarray, which will have all sorts of implications potentially for our ability to be effective in the world. And if we're not effective in the world, what we will see is even greater instability, or again, to use the word disarray, beyond our borders.
Well, that inaugural address was written in large part by Steve Bannon, and there is a sense among, in fact, Foreign Policy, where you have published a number of articles through the years, quoted an intelligence official which wanted to remain anonymous as saying that Steve Bannon is now in control of policy and process on national security, and there's no paper trail. In other words, he talks about it as a cabal, like a shadow National Security Council meeting in private meetings and not having anything on the record. I mean, there have been comparisons to Valerie Jarrett in terms of his role. There have been comparisons, certainly, going back to Karl Rove. But nobody has quite had, in many people's minds, such a sinister role. I use that word not even necessarily advisedly. He's talked himself about wanting chaos and wanting disarray, wanting to have the state crumble so he could start anew.
Well, there's lots I could say, but on the last point you made, yeah, there is a bias in this administration, and you see it in Mr. Bannon, you see it in President Trump. There's a bias in favor of disruption, and they're going in position, which I think is fundamentally wrong, just to put it on the table, but they're going in position is that large elements of what is going on in this country and what is going on in the world works against us. And again, you can see it in the inaugural address, but the basic premise is that the United States has spent a lot more than it's gotten. If you will, it's been a bad investment for the United States to be active in the world. So they want to disrupt relationships. They want to end important elements of what has been traditional foreign policy. We saw it in the first week, the demise of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade agreement. You see questioning of allied relationships. You see questioning of long-term policies, be it with China, Mexico, or any number of other countries. So there is this disruptive bias. In the case of Mr. Bannon personally, yeah, you've got a situation where, first of all, the White House has outsized impact. To some extent, this happens early in many administrations because the White House staff doesn't need to be confirmed by the Senate. And the people running the State Department, the Pentagon, and other agencies do need to be confirmed. We still don't have, for example, the Secretary of State, much less anybody else at the senior policy level.
We should mention that you were considered for the word was floating around as Deputy Secretary of State before the appointments were made.
Well, again, you know, I only know what I read. No formal or even informal discussion about those possibilities ever took place. And my point is simply that you've got a lot of people in the White House already there. You've got a White House-centric administration. Whether this changes over time, I don't know. And you've also had this new national security directive, which puts the senior strategist, Mr. Bannon, in a formal position on the National Security Council, which is unprecedented. So at a time when the director of national intelligence and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff will only be there when invited or when required to be there, the idea that he is now a fixture at the table is, to me, an extraordinary statement.
Extraordinary, particularly in the fact that the administration seems to be trying to sell the public on the idea that somehow as a naval officer he's entitled to sit here, and the downgrading of the chief of staff and, well, others, frankly, also plays into this equation. But I want to get your response to the most recent news, Acting Attorney General Sally Yates, essentially a holdover from the Obama administration, fired and very summarily fired and called a betrayer by President Trump. We spoke earlier with Hugh Hewitt, a conservative talk show host who you probably are familiar with, and he said this was the right thing to do because the ban is law under executive order, and therefore she was defying the law as opposed to standing up for a principle as many saw it.
Well, again, any individual has the right to stand up for principle. In this case, though, it is the law. I don't agree with it. I think it is counterproductive, to say the least. I think many aspects of this law will make the United States less rather than more safe. That's on the other hand, the president enjoys tremendous latitude and discretion when it comes to setting immigration policy, and he did just that. So at the end of the day, individuals can act almost a civil disobedience, but the president is ultimately going to remove people until he gets people in place who will follow out the law that he has, again, the prerogative to set.
We're talking with Richard Haass. He is president of the Council on Foreign Relations, and his new book is called The World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order. That liberal world order is giving way. You know, I think of Yates's language, the center may not hold here. I mean, especially sure. With the kind of things that you bring up that are in the picture for us. I mentioned them to some extent in my introduction when I talked about the difficulties and the challenges of maintaining global stability in light of climate change, global terrorism, and nuclear proliferation. And one thing also that came to mind, I had an interview not that long ago with Ted Koppel, and he's talking about cyber warfare and vulnerability. Sure. I mean, hacking going on, you know, constantly in terms of, what constitutes not only foreign relations and secrets of different nation states, but also what goes on domestically in terms of their own political processes.
Well, everything you're mentioning here, Michael, you're exactly right. These are all manifestations of globalization. These are all concerning things, phenomena, whether it's cyber or global warming or terrorists or disease. These are all about the movements across borders, often with great speed and in great volume, in ways that governments can't control. And I would actually say this is the defining challenge of this era of history. And unfortunately, a large gap has opened up between the scale of these challenges and the degree or nature of the international response. We talk about international community all the time, but the cold, hard fact is there's precious little international community. And that's what we're seeing on issue after issue after issue. And what concerns me is, you know, history shows that international community or consensus just doesn't emerge on its own. It often takes a leading role for the United States, but now we have an administration that's talking about America first. And I think there's obvious tension between the United States taking a very narrow view of its self-interest and the purpose of its foreign policy and trying to get the world to, in some ways, come together, at least in part, to deal with these challenges that no single country, including the United States, can deal with effectively on its own. So I worry about the direction that we are heading in.
Well, you talk in your book about a world that ought to be, to some extent, patterned on sovereign obligations, sovereignty being a new central principle maybe for U.S. foreign policy. That is terrorism, climate change, whatever.
Right.
The country ought to own it, you know, when it comes from that country or emanates from that country. And, you know, it certainly sounds like not only a reasonable but a wise way to turn our attentions, particularly since, as you say, nation states after the 30-year war back in the mid-1600s became pretty much preeminent. But you can still make the argument that sovereignty is part of the difficulty, that sovereignty leads to a kind of nationalism, maybe even America First type of fervent nationalism that has been the cause of so many wars and so much disruption.
I don't think sovereignty is the problem, because sovereignty is an innovation. When it came around nearly four centuries ago, was a way in which governments or countries didn't constantly interfere in one another or invade one another. What we now see in the modern world, though, is that's necessary still. We don't want to have additional cases of a Russia, say, invading a country like Ukraine. We don't want to see more, say, of an Iraq invading Kuwait. But it's while it's necessary, it's no longer sufficient. And going back to what we were just discussing in the say about cyber or climate change, nothing stays local for long. Virtually anything that goes on within the borders of a country, one way or another, can get on the conveyor belt of globalization and affect other countries. We saw it, say, with refugees coming out of the Middle East and the impact it had on Europe. And my argument is simply that in this day and age, while we need to keep sovereignty, we also need sovereign states to take on some obligations, and they need to monitor or police or regulate what goes on inside their own territory of those things that could hurt or harm others. And I think this ought to be the compass for American foreign policy. And again, not as an act of international charity or philanthropy, but we ourselves, we the United States, we Americans, we will not thrive in a world that unravels. To the extent there's growing disarray in the world, we are going to pay an enormous price. So we need to do this. We need to spread this idea of sovereign obligation, and we need to live up to it. We can't just talk the talk. We have got to walk the walk.
Does that mean we trade in what you call our global sheriff role, or we alter that? To what degree we alter that?
Well, I think to some extent we still have to be the world's leader. There's no alternative to us. Indeed, the alternative to a U.S.-led world, I believe, is a nobody-led world. And it's a world that deteriorates. And the Middle East and even Europe to some extent now is evidence of what happens in that case. But we can't do it unilaterally. So sheriff is probably a little bit too strong of a metaphor. But what we want to do is take the lead. We want to work with others when they're willing and able to work with us. And we want to promote a new consensus. Again, I call it World Order 2.0, about what will be the rules, the norms, the arrangements, the institutions that will essentially manage the challenges of a 21st century world.
But you're saying sovereign states have to meet obligations, a whole range of obligations, and sometimes
sure.
What those obligations are go counterpoint, go diametrically opposed to how other sovereign states see their obligations.
Again, that's why we have diplomats, and that's why you have to consult and negotiate. And in some cases, we may have to incentivize other countries to do certain things. We may have to introduce sanctions of one sort or another if they don't. Look, we've already been shown our willingness to use military force when a country doesn't meet its sovereign obligation to make sure the terrorists don't operate out of their territory. we may have to contemplate using military force against North Korea, which is a country that is fast developing nuclear weapons that can go on ballistic missiles that could reach the United States. So not all of this is going to be voluntary. I would like it to be voluntary, but I think we have to understand that there will always be outliers, and we've got to decide what it is we and others are prepared to do with those who refuse to sign up to or live by the norms.
Well, we're fraught with nuclear dangers. I mean, that goes without saying. You mentioned North Korea. You think about Pakistan. Other nations have nuclear weaponry, but there also seems to be, in many people's minds, fear about the present now, under, that is, Donald Trump, who has talked somewhat loosely in many people's minds about not only nuclear weaponry with respect to Japan and South Korea, but also who has talked about the need to advance nuclear weaponry. And we've heard the same from Putin. I don't know how friendly these two really are, but they're talking about maybe another nuclear arms race.
It's not something I would want to see. If we are going to spend more money on defense, I think it's much better spent on conventional weapons and on our soldiers. We already have more than sufficient numbers of nuclear weapons. I think there is a case for some modernization, but we don't want to return nuclear weapons to the centrality that they often occupied during the Cold War, particularly against the backdrop of deteriorating relations between the United States and Russia, and also conceivably the United States and China. I think we, over the years, did a good job, the major powers, the quote-unquote superpowers, of reducing the number and role of nuclear weapons, and I would hate to see that reversed.
Talking with Richard Haass, again, he is a consul, foreign relations president, and also author of a new book called The World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old World Order. Let's talk a bit, since you mentioned, Richard, about U.S. relations with both China and Russia. You say in your book that China is the most important relationship for the United States, mm-hmm. and you make the case. But it would seem at this point that President Trump wants a closer relationship, maybe call it a reset with Russia. And in fact, certainly during the campaign, his rhetoric was very strong against China, whom he may personally be in debt to. The United States is certainly in debt to a great degree. But he was talking as if China is, killing us in trade wars and has to be the scoundrel here or the villain to be centered upon. I'd like to hear your comment on that.
Well, again, I flat out disagree with that perception. I'm not going to sit here, though, Michael, and say that China's always played by the rules when it comes to trade. Of course, it hasn't. It's been guilty of stealing intellectual property. There have been times at which it has manipulated its currency to advantage its exports, though it hasn't done that for the last few years. It continues to give large state subsidies of certain businesses. But China is also an important force in the world of trade. It's one of our two or three largest export markets. So I don't want to have a trade war with China. What I want to do is essentially evolve or amend the global trading regime in order to get China to step up. That's part of the tragedy of the killing off of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because even though it didn't include China, it would have set a new set of standards, and we would have had a race to the top, and China would have been pressured to join and to step up to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now that this administration has killed it off, then I think what's more likely is China will play a large role in setting much lower standards for regional and world trade. And I believe the United States and others will be worse off as a result.
Yeah, but we might add that Bernie Sanders was opposed, and finally Hillary Clinton came and did a turnabout,
sure.
And she was opposed as well. So whomever would have been in the executive office, it was doomed. But I want to get right to the point here that you sort of brought to our attention here with respect to China. Here is a sovereign state that believes that it has certain rights in the South China Sea, rights to Taiwan, rights that much of the world doesn't necessarily agree with, particularly the West and particularly the United States. Would add to that rights to Tibet, too, of course.
Well, look, just quickly go through it. China obviously has certain positions on the South China Sea that we and more than a half dozen other countries don't sign up to. We can't force them to give up those rights. We just want to modify how it is they act on them, and we need to continue to fly over and sail through those areas of sea and islands in order to demonstrate that these do not belong to China. I'm actually more concerned about Taiwan. This is an issue that's been finessed now for, 45 years. And we have gotten the Chinese not to use force to bring together, to forcibly bring Taiwan back into China. Taiwan, meanwhile, has flourished economically. It's a flourishing and thriving democracy. And this just seems to me to – there's no argument to suddenly put on the table the idea that we need to think about a change in the so-called One China policy. This has worked for us for 45 years. It's worked for Taiwan, and it's allowed China and the United States to develop a reasonable relationship. I am worried that if this changes, we could find ourselves in a dangerous crisis. Plus, it would virtually rule out any prospect of Chinese cooperation to meet what, again, I think is the most pressing regional challenge in that part of the world, which is from North Korea.
Well, let's go to the Middle East, though, because we were talking about China and Russia, and now I want to talk about North Korea, too. But now you have President Trump talking about the possibility of making an alliance with Prime Minister Putin and actually making some headway in Syria. I mean, the United States under President Obama said red line and then backed off of that and said that Assad has to be removed and that was not brought into fruition. So now we have a president who is saying we can work with the Russians and we can do more damage to ISIS and we can maybe even bring about a political resolution in Syria.
That's conceivable. You know, we probably don't have enough time to go through all that happened or didn't happen in Syria over the last six or so years. I would just make one point that I believe the U.S. experience with Syria shows that what you don't do in foreign policy, acts of omission, if you will, can be every bit as consequential and every bit as meaningful as what it is you do. And I think we ought to take that lesson to heart. But we are where we are in Syria, and essentially the regime of Bashar al-Assad has been shored up. It is relatively stable thanks to Russian and Iranian intervention. So I believe we've got to downsize our policy, which means to accept it, however reluctantly, for the foreseeable future. We ought to focus on going after ISIS in Syria, where they have their largest presence. And we ought to see if we can do more to protect individual Syrians, civilians, and whether we can support a transitional political process led probably by the UN, where Russia has a large role. That's where we are.
I remind you that we're talking with Richard Haass. His new book is A World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order. We do welcome your involvement in this conversation. Let me tell you how you can join us. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786. Again, join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and simply click on the segment. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We do welcome and encourage your involvement, though. We do want to hear from you. We're talking about a whole range of things, of course, but particularly about world affairs and the United States' role, especially in the age of Trump. And you may have questions or comments for Richard Haass, and we certainly, again, indeed, encourage you to bring them to the fore here. So please feel free to join us. Again, he's President of the Council on Foreign Relations, and the book is A World in Disarray. And we'll hear from you when we return. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're joined this hour by Richard Haass, who is the head of the Council on Foreign Relations and who has a new book out called A World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order. And in it, he essentially offers a warning. In this age of climate change and global terrorism and nuclear proliferation and so much more globalization has wrought, nations must adopt a new mantle of international responsibility and obligation. Richard, how does that fit in with news that's just breaking here? This is actually UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is calling on President Trump to lift the ban on travelers as soon as possible. Is that going to have any weight or leverage?
Unfortunately not. The president seems determined to forge ahead with what I see as a policy that I think we talked about it before, that is more likely to make us less safe than more safe. It will, I think, potentially alienate or even radicalize elements of the Muslim American community. And there's 3 million Muslim Americans. And as recent violent attacks over the last couple of years have shown, that's the real danger. I'm much less concerned about people coming across the border, in part because there's relatively few of them compared to the, again, the large number of Muslim Americans. Plus, we have, after 9/11, put into place fairly strong and capable security protections, and we've already got an awful lot of vetting. So I feel almost as if this new policy is, quote-unquote, fixing a problem that doesn't really exist. It's going to exacerbate the problem that does exist. And it's also going to make it more difficult for us to get the kind of support we want around the world from select Muslim nations. And all of this has nothing to do with, you know, one could add the humanitarian tragedy of this, what it could mean for American corporations and businesses, what it could mean for American universities.
And so what it means for intelligence, for those who tend to work with us as translators and as allies.
It's absolutely. Yeah, it sends a terrible message that if you take personal risk and you associate or affiliate yourself with the United States, we do not have your back. And in the intelligence business, it is essential that those who take risks for us know that we will be prepared to come to their defense should their association with us suddenly put them at real risk. So this has not just immediate, but this has real long-term consequences.
Okay, I want to go to callers and emailers, and we'll get to as many of you as we can. But I did promise that I would ask Richard Haass about his thoughts about North Korea, and I'll tell you very boldly, I hope, what my thoughts are. It seems to be a cul-de-sac. I mean, every time something comes up about we're going to work with China, we're going to pressure them, we're going to have sanctions, we're going to try to talk to them and so forth, everything seems to fall through. Any more beacon of hope from this Trump administration?
It reminds me of an old comment by a former Secretary of Defense, Harold Brown, when he was talking about the Soviets. And he said, when we build, they build. And when we don't build, they build. And in the case of North Korea, when we talk to them, they go ahead with their program. And when we sanction them, they go ahead with their program.
Exactly right. Yeah.
So, you know, the question is what we do now. I think we could make a big effort to get China to help, to use the influence it says it doesn't have, but in many ways it does, given how much of North Korea's economy depends upon China. I think it's worth taking a shot at that, but I can't sit here, Michael, and tell you it will succeed. North Korea clearly wants nuclear weapons, both for the prestige, but also for the security. They've taken a look around the world, and they've noted that countries that gave up their nuclear weapons in many cases have been invaded, and the leadership no longer exists. They look at Ukraine, they look at Libya, they look at Iraq. So for them, nuclear weapons are a real security shield. And then your options, if you can't get them to give it up one way or another, is either to live with it, and that's through a mixture of defense and deterrence, and that the obvious risks there are given the mercurial nature of North Korea's leadership and regime. Do we want to do that? And your other set of options is one way or another to attack it, whether with cyber, conventional military force, or both. And there, obviously, the danger is how the North Koreans would retaliate. And we can't just do all this unilaterally because we have South Korea and Japan who are very much in harm's way. And working all this out with our partners at the same time, working with China and working with North Korea, this is a foreign policy problem from hell. And it's been with us for several decades now. And I think, though, it's finally reaching a point where we're going to have to live under a direct threat from North Korea, or we're going to have to one way or another figure out a way to dismantle that threat.
It is the lowest circle of hell, to bring Dante into this, if I may say so, as an editorial comment, because as you suggest, and as I've been saying all along, it doesn't seem to be a way to actually, well, get in charge of this or get a hold of it or get somehow taming it. Let me bring our callers in the meantime. Damien joining us first. Damien, you're on.
Thank you. Always good to hear the show. First thing is I'm glad that Syria is where it's at and that now maybe the United States can actually play a positive role because Syria is going to need a lot of aid. And I think the United States can start stepping in and help towards the reconciliation process and maybe even the political process. Another point is I have a question regarding your disarray. Would it not be safe to say that, in fact, that because other nations are becoming richer, that we're just getting more points of power? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you for the call. And sort of dovetailing on this, I'm looking at some of the comments that are coming in here, Richard. Here's Chris who says, why is the world in disarray after 8 years of the Nobel Prize winning Exalted One? Anyway.
Okay, look, I think the caller made a really good point, his second point. One of the reasons the world is in disarray we've been talking about is globalization. The other principal reason, though, is one that he was putting his finger on, which is the spread of power or capacity, military, economic, you name it, in more and more hands. So we've got far more players, whether they're countries or groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda, that can make a difference. And we've got far more centers of decision-making. So it makes it far more difficult to corral the world, to get some kind of a collective response, much less a consensus. So our ability, the American ability to dictate or even heavily control things has been much diluted, first by globalization and then by the spread of power into all these hands. And again, getting to that other point, but we've added to it. I think that the world is in disarray, not just for those reasons, but also for things the United States has done. Here I would put things like the 2003 Iraq War, the Libya intervention, the decision to pull U.S. troops out of Iraq after Iraq was restabilized, and then all the things we haven't done. Again, all the many decisions not to get involved in Syria, even after, say, chemical weapons were used, not to follow up the Libyan invasion, or more recently, to kill off the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade agreement. So in part, you know, we've reached the point we've reached in history because of thing, you know, if you will, basic historical forces, but also decisions taken by the United States and others, things we've done, things we've decided not to do, have had a real impact. And the only optimism in this, Michael, is that if in part what we did and didn't do got us to where we are, it suggests to me that what we do or not do going forward could potentially improve things. It's not automatic, but the possibility of getting it right is there. But to be perfectly honest, so too is the possibility of making a bad situation worse.
Well, good sanguine view, and we'll get some more calls on for you. Robert joins us next. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I was not surprised to see the fighting in eastern Ukraine coming into the headlines again last night, and I was curious about Richard's ideas about how the Ukraine might evolve over the next few months and what he thinks the Trump administration may or may not do, given his sort of inability to say anything negative about Putin. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you for the question, Richard Haas.
Yeah, what this brings up, which we didn't get to, is the basic question of what to do about Russia, including Ukraine. Look, what Russia did in Ukraine was a fundamental violation of what I would call World Order 1.0. What it did was it eclipsed important aspects of Ukraine's sovereignty, and it set a terrible precedent. What I believe we should have done and what I believe we should do is give Ukraine some greater capacity to defend itself. And I think that's important. I also believe that we ought to take steps to make sure there are not additional Ukraines, including the Baltic states, which are NATO members. So we should build on some steps that began in the last year or two of the Obama administration to reintroduce significant military forces into NATO Europe, because a lot of these forces were taken out in the years after the end of the Cold War. That said, I don't want to get into a new Cold War with Russia, much less a hot one. And I'm open to the idea of having conversations with them. We talked about potentially working together in Syria. I can imagine working together in Afghanistan. If it takes some reassurance of Mr. Putin to let him know that we're not trying to bring about a revolution in his country to unseat him, I'd be willing to talk about that. I see no reason to press ahead with NATO enlargement, additional NATO enlargement at this time. I would simply say that if we want better relations with Russia, though, we have to understand that what we're not interested in is cosmetic improvements. What we want is a better relationship that results from Russian behavior that is more consistent with the established norms and principles of international relations.
But there seems to be, as we alluded to before, Richard, a kind of desire by this administration, particularly by President Trump, to get closer relations and reset a closer friendship with Russia. And that has meant, in many people's minds, a diminution of NATO. It's also meant a Secretary of State who also has very close ties to Russia and Putin, who was honored by Putin, in fact. And does that mean, just apropos of the caller's question, does that mean perhaps more willingness to go along with Russian ideas of expansionism or reforming at least their sovereign state in the way they see it should be reformed?
Well, that would be a colossal mistake. Again, the idea is not a better relationship is an end in itself. the ideas, a more stable Europe and a more stable world. And again, what I believe it needs, this requires is some strengthening of NATO. We need to make our commitment to Europe's security not simply a rhetorical one, but we need to make it clear that it is a real one, and Russia has to understand that there are real limits to what we would tolerate. But that said, our goals are not unlimited, and we're not trying to overthrow the Putin government. We're not necessarily trying to expand NATO anymore at this time. So I think there are some things, there's a potential for compromise, but it's got to be on terms that are consistent with our obligations to NATO and are consistent with the security and stability of Europe.
Well, President Trump has made a point a number of times about the cost of supporting NATO, the cost of supporting mm-hmm. our allies in Europe. I'm looking at actually a question here from a listener named Mike who says, our current world order has been essentially unchanged since 1946. Does the United States really owe the rest of the world the duty of spending in perpetuity on our military than the next 20-some countries combined?
Well, first of all, the United States has spent what it's spent and done what it's done in NATO, Europe, and beyond, not as an act of philanthropy, not as an act of charity, but as an act of self-interest. We took the proper lesson after World War I and World War II that we needed to have a balance of power in Europe and a balance of power in Asia for our own self-interest, given our own security needs, given our own economic needs, given our own beliefs in freedom. So we have done just that. And yes, it's cost us considerably, but let's keep it in perspective. All we're spending on defense now is roughly what? It's a level of GDP between 3 and 3.5% of what it is we produce economically. That's roughly half, give or take, of what the average was during the Cold War. And my point is simply that not only do we benefit from what it is we spend on defense, but history has shown that we can spend this level or even higher levels of our wealth on defense and still thrive economically. So the argument that somehow we're impoverishing ourselves because of what we're doing in the world is simply doesn't bear scrutiny.
I'm going to go to more of your calls in a moment. I want to go to a comment from, well, actually a question from a listener named Paul who says, I've seen people repost a Facebook comment from a Boston College history professor about shock events in history, that is, unexpected and confusing events designed to shock the world into chaos and thus distract them from some other action. Do you think a shock event is a realistic possibility to explain Trump and his team's behavior? In other words, diverting our attention, I think, is what he's getting at here, which has been brought up on this program, too.
I guess I don't understand in the sense that Mr. Trump is going to try to divert our attention or that he himself somehow reflects that. You've lost me here.
That both, I think, seem to be operative. Was the immigration ban, for example, a way of diverting our attention from other things that may be in the works or going on?
Well, I think what we've learned after, 10, 11, 12 days of Mr. Trump's presidency is that he's going to do a good many, if not all of the things that he said he was going to do as a campaigner. This is not always the case. So he's acting very quickly. In many cases, he's doing it through executive order. And also in foreign policy and national security policy writ large, presidents enjoy tremendous discretionary authority. The congressional role is relatively modest by comparison. So Mr. Trump is doing an awful lot. So I don't think he's distracting. I think this is his agenda. And I think it's against traditional trade. It's questioning the role of allies. He's obviously introduced the idea of a closer relationship with Russia and a more distant relationship from both China and Mexico. This is, in some ways, he has become the disruptor in chief. And it's a very different kind of foreign policy. What it reminds me of is a little bit of the healthcare debate that I see in the healthcare debate a greater emphasis on repeal rather than replace. And I think we're seeing something of the foreign policy analog. We're seeing a large degree of repealing of the old foreign policy order and the old international order. It's not at all obvious to me, though, Michael, what this administration plans to put in its place.
Yeah, the question here I'm looking at from a listener named Noel ties right to what you just said. Why do you think Trump and Bannon might be against the one China policy?
Well, again, Mr. Trump has this view that somehow the United States has been ripped off or lost in its economic dealings with China. And the truth is both countries, I believe, have gained significantly from the economic relationship. In some ways, we've almost become dependent on one another. I think he underestimates China's potential importance in dealing with some global challenges as well as the North Korean challenge. There are some people around him, though, who take a very negative view of China's economic behavior, also who believe that the United States and China are inevitably going to become great power rivals. So their view is, well, since that's inevitable, we might as well try to cut China down to size before it happens. I think that's a real misreading of history. It's not inevitable, and it would be a great diplomatic failure were a new Cold War between us to arise. But there again, there is that difference.
Here's a caller, Jessica, joining us. You're on the air, Jessica. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for hosting Richard Haass. I used to work at the Council on Foreign Relations in the 90s under Peter Tarnoff during the fall of the Soviet Union. And I have a simple question, which is, what can globally minded citizens do to show the world we don't stand with Trump's xenophobic policies? And will any of these things that we try to do, like protesting at airports, have any effect either nationally or internationally?
Well, I think the protests at airports and demonstrations of civil society in this country send a message to the world that the government doesn't necessarily speak for all the citizens. I also think citizens have the opportunity to influence Congress. They have got the ability to influence media, NGOs, and all aspects of civil society. And they also have the opportunity to get involved in the political process. And if you don't like what this president or this Congress is doing, then there's an opportunity to go to the polls and work politically so the next Congress and the next president turn out to be different. This is this is what politics are all about. Mr. Trump was elected, and he is doing what he set out to do. And I understand that a lot of people disagree strongly with large parts of his agenda. I disagree with significant parts of his agenda. So to me, that's an argument for getting more, not less, involved in politics.
Let me thank the caller and go to a question, Richard, about something that appeared in The Economist, which writes about the United States falling from a full democracy to a flawed one. And they argue that this happened the same year that Donald Trump was elected president, but he was not the cause. This is the Economist Intelligence Unit's annual Democracy Index, which I'm sure you're familiar with, titled Revenge of the Deplorables. They say it proves that the country that once ranked among the 20 full democracies now lies in the group of 57 flawed democracies, dropping below Uruguay and Japan, downgrade due to erosion of trust in U.S. government and elected officials, caused confidence in government to plummet to historic lows. And they write, this is not the consequence of Donald Trump. On the contrary, the election of Mr. Trump as U.S. president was in large part a consequence of the longstanding problems of the democracy in the United States.
I agree, and I think it reflects a lack of voter participation, the fact that barely more than half of those eligible to vote in presidential contests bother to vote is to me a real indictment of the process. I think that a lot of Americans, whether it's the result of what we teach or fail to teach in our schools or more broadly, aren't aware of the facts and the realities behind many of the issues. The idea that a lot of people think we have a major influx of individuals from Mexico, when in fact over the last 5 years there's been a net outflow of Mexicans leaving the United States going to Mexico, is the sort of example of that. Many people, I think, have flawed understanding of why jobs are disappearing. They blame it or scapegoat trade, when in fact that 80 to 90% of those jobs that disappear because of the introduction of new technologies. I think in some ways what we have is the Economist makes a fair point that Mr. Trump may contribute to some of these trends, but in many ways he is the beneficiary of many of these trends. So to me, it argues for a more informed electorate and greater political participation. And in some of the economic areas, I think it also argues for doing more for people whose jobs are disappearing. And that means having better systems for re-education, for retraining through the course of one's life and career, more sorts of social and economic help for people going through economic transitions. I think we've got to do more to gear our society so we can deal with the pressures of globalization and even more technological innovation.
Again, Richard Haas is with us. Let me get a quick response from Richard, from a listener named Mike, who says it's going to be hard to stop nuclear proliferation so long as we tolerate the existence of Israel's nuclear arsenal, a major destabilizer in that volatile part of the world.
I actually disagree with Mike. Israel has had nuclear weapons for decades, and it has not led to the nuclear to further nuclear proliferation in the Middle East. The only country, originally in that part of the world that moved in that direction was Iraq, and that, I don't think that was largely to deal with Israel. I think it was more to promote Iraq's own position in the region and to offset what its concerns about Iran. Now, again, Iran is developing the prerequisites of nuclear weapons. For the time being, there seems to be a ceiling on that. But I think that long-term challenge remains. And again, I think Iran might well be doing this even if Israel didn't have nuclear weapons, because it would back Iran's push to be, if not the principal regional power in that part.
And that would move forward Saudi Arabia, Egypt, possibly thinking they would want to be in a nuclear arms race. We're talking, by the way, with Richard Haas. He's president of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's author of a new book called The World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old War Order. And you're listening to Forum. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to another caller, and let's bring Bryce on the air. Bryce, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi. Thank you, Michael. I just wanted to say that I hope my fellow Americans will try to remember why we created this post-World War II order, which is that when the world sat back and let imperial nations in Europe and Asia start gobbling up neighbors and eroding basic values of sovereignty, we wound up with World War II, which was an incredible tragedy, cost in lives and treasure, and that if we don't stand up and spend what we have to spend and do what we have to do to stand against this same kind of resurgence, whether it's the South China Sea or the Ukraine, we'll find ourselves in that same position, and we'll lose a heck of a lot more if we don't have the courage to stand up for the world order that we helped create to avoid that tragedy happening again.
Go to Richard Haas.
Well, I'm pretty sympathetic to what that caller just said. It's a little bit like the old adage, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And we've learned the hard way in history that when we come to, if you will, liberate areas rather than defend them, it's a lot more costly in lives and treasure. And again, the good news is we can do what we need to do in the world and do what we need to do here in the United States. This idea that there's an inevitable or inexorable trade-off between guns and butter, and we've got to choose between the two, isn't true. We've got enough capacity and wealth to do both, and indeed, we need to do both. Getting back to the basic idea of this book, A World in Disarray, my whole argument is that what goes on there doesn't stay there, that nothing is local for long anymore. So we've got to be active in the world, in large part to make sure that here at home, we have the sort of society and country that's secure and prosperous that we want to have.
Here's Martin. Martin, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks. Certainly, I'm very aligned with everything that Richard and this program has talked about. But my struggle is that I've got friends and family in Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, Minnesota, Montana, in these places. And they love Trump. They love everything that he's doing. And what I question, though, is that discussions like this, which are about, short-term strategies, long-term strategies about foreign policy, that to them it just doesn't matter because they're already in such a segregated, segmented part of society. Why doesn't it matter to that portion of America? And that's the over 50 white, uneducated American. I don't know. But why do you think it doesn't matter to them?
Want to speculate on that, Richard Haas?
That's one of those questions. If I speculate on too much, I'll probably get in trouble. But look, I think...
By the way, I should add, there are a lot of educated Americans who also support Trump.
Exactly. But also, I think it does matter. I think some of these communities and individuals are obviously concerned most about their own economic situation. A lot of their jobs have disappeared. Again, I think more for reasons of technological innovation than because of unfair trading by others. A lot of them haven't had the education or retraining they need to get a new job. We have millions of jobs in this country that are going empty But people, there's not a good fit between the workforce and those jobs. A lot of these individuals don't have enough money saved for a comfortable retirement. So you've got a lot of people living on the edge, and I understand why they're concerned. And foreign policy is not their preoccupation. And I think, again, there's a natural inclination to see what we're spending elsewhere somehow coming at the expense of what we need to do at home, or there's bitterness against unfair practices or by foreigners or ungrateful foreigners. But I think, again, that's not accurate in most cases. And what I call for in the book, and I don't think we're likely to see, is a president who uses the Oval Office as a classroom to explain some of these realities. I think Americans can ultimately more than hold their own in this global world, in this competitive world. But we've got to put into place the educational and other support systems we need to do it. Otherwise, we are going to be ultimately look for things like protection, or we're going to shut out immigrants, even though the history of our country shows that immigrants have been the greatest single source of job creation that we have known.
I think the last president could have been described as what he was, a classroom professor, but this one...
But he didn't use it. He was a bit of a disappointment in that, because I thought he had great rhetorical skills. But for the most part, I don't think he helped in some ways take the country through this conversation nearly as much as he could and should. And as you said before, Michael, the fact that all three candidates, Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, and Donald Trump, came out against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, I thought that was a real statement about how the debate, or the center of the debate in this country, had moved.
Richard Haass has been with us this hour. Always good to have you on. Thank you for being with us.
Great to be here, as always, sir.
And let me remind people that he is president of the Council on Foreign Relations, and his new book is called A World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order. And also remind you that you can continue this discussion online by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. And you can also let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or what you'd like to hear on Forum. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And the program is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, Judy Campbell, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from Amanda Font and Jeremy Siegel. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Executive producer, Holly Kernan. Thank you for listening, and for all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.